Hello, and welcome back to another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Arzu, a cancer survivor, as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. I'm also part of the Cancer Smart Initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice. On today's episode, I am very excited to be joined by a woman of incredible strength and determination. She always manages to brighten up my Instagram feed with her fun reels, selfies, and her raw videos documenting her cancer journey. She is a mom, a wife, and the face behind ovarian cancer and other stories on Instagram, Lisa. Welcome to the podcast, Lisa.
Oh, thank you for having me.
No worries, Lisa. I'm just so excited to have you join me today to share your cancer story in your words.
Well, I'm just hoping I live up to the introduction.
I have no doubt that you will. And I know that you have a CT scan this afternoon, but you still managed to join the episode today and share your story. So I'm incredibly grateful to have you on our show today.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Perfect. So, you know, without further ado, would you like to tell the listeners a bit more about yourself so they get to know you better?
Okay, so as you've said, my name's Lisa Robson, and up until 5 years ago, if anybody had asked me about myself, I would have said, you know, I was a mum, a wife, a designer, worked full time, had a really busy life. And that kind of changed 5 years ago when I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. All of those things still apply, but maybe the order is slightly different. Not as busy as I was. Don't work full time now, but still managed to do some work. So it was a bit of a total life change 5 years
ago. Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, you're still all the other things that I mentioned you were, but you're also now an ovarian cancer fighter, which is truly inspirational. I'm so excited to get to know more about you. So to begin with, you know, would you like to tell the listeners a bit more about your cancer journey and how it all started, really?
Okay, so I would say the symptoms of ovarian cancer started probably at least 2 years before my diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I had different symptoms. I had some tummy pain. I had a bit of back pain. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the hospital A&E a couple of times because I did have blood in my poo. My periods had always been very regular, but then became slightly irregular. Mm-hmm. So this went on for I would say 2 years. I also had a lot of pain when I was having sex. So I'd been to the GP thinking maybe it was premenopause, maybe, you start to worry about a lot of things that and attribute a lot of things to the menopause. I was 49, so I kind of knew the possibility. And really, they just became, I think the symptoms are low. Looking back, they were quite bad. They just became my normal. At the start of the 2 years, I was still cycling to work, which was a kind of 7 kilometre round trip. So I was still really fit. By the end of that 2 years, I couldn't even cycle to the local cafe, which is kind of round the corner and up the road, you know. So things were going, things were getting worse quite quickly towards the end, kind of ramping up. Usually there were things like the tummy pain would be put down to a pulled muscle by the GP, or maybe a urine infection, but my urine checks would always come back clear. So there were lots of different things that these symptoms were attributed to. Eventually, I saw a GP who said, look, we're going to do an ultrasound scan. And I had that on the 4th of May, 2016. And right. by the time I had the ultrasound, I had kind of a mound sticking out of my tummy. So wow. It happened very quickly over the April.
Yeah.
By the time I had the ultrasound, I could say to the look, it's kind of there. And it was a bit pointy mound. And the ultrasound technician and her colleague that was in the room said, you need to see your GP tomorrow. I heard complex cysts, septum. They were bilateral, so there were one on each side. One was 15 centimetres, one was 9 centimetres. So I literally made an emergency appointment to see my GP the next day, which I was just so grateful that they'd kind of pointed me in that direction.
Yeah.
I saw my GP and asked for a referral to the local Centre for Gynae Oncology, which was at Gateshead in the Queen Elizabeth Gateshead. And that was because even though I'd not ever heard of ovarian cancer, I knew that if I went somewhere that kind of specialised in kind of gynae oncology, I'd be in the right place.
As opposed
to the usual pathway would have been going to my local hospital, which is South Shields, which isn't a centre for any kind of gynae problems. And that would have added another step into the process that by that time I was really starting to, not panic would be the wrong word. I think it was just starting to think, okay, this is going to be an operation maybe to get rid of them, or not like a pulled muscle or IBS or something that could just be kind of, I could wait till it went away or take some medication. So that was kind of the first part of the journey.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, was your thinking that it's a cyst, for example, and did you have any thoughts about cancer at this very stage of your journey?
At the time, I am such an optimist. I've always been an optimist. I'm always glass half full. I'm not a pessimist. So in my head, everything was going to be fine.
Yeah.
I truly believed that I would go in, I would have one of those keyhole, three-hole surgery things, and they'd take them out, and that would be it. It didn't even enter my head that it could be cancer. It was literally just, I'm probably going to have a hysterectomy, which I knew was quite, you know, was quite a big operation.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't even know whether I'd got that far. So it wasn't really until I saw the surgeon. And I'd actually met him a year before. I'd gone to him a year before with all my symptoms.
Oh, right.
He'd given me all clear. So I think he was in shock. I was definitely in shock. And then he, little by little, they did the CA125 test, and then they did something called a Roma test, which is a combination of different blood tests. And every test came back in kind of adding a bit more to the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And also things were getting a little bit worse. So it went from it's unlikely to be this to it could be this to it looks like it will be this. By the time I was told that it was likely ovarian cancer, I think my head had already got to the destination. It was slow. But it helped actually in a way, because I think had I just gone from thinking I was fine to having a diagnosis of cancer, I think I don't know whether I would have been able to cope. So that slow movement into a different place was actually probably really helpful for me. However, I still had a holiday to booked for 3 weeks after the surgery. I thought that I would be up and out and at them. I had really no clue. I think because I didn't understand ovarian cancer, I didn't really have a clue that, you know, I'll always liken ovarian cancer to spilled glitter in a makeup bag. You know, you go in, you think you've got it all out, but it spreads, you know, it's got the whole of your kind of your abdominal cavity to play with. So it's you, unless it's contained and it's epithelial ovarian cancer, it kind of has a bit of a free reign. So by the time they did operate, I was stage 3C. So it was around my bowel, my bladder, behind my kidney. And I've got something called a horseshoe kidney. Mm. So my kidneys are joined together. So actually I had a 3-centimetre tumour behind my kidney joined, and this surgeon went in and got it out. So he did recover himself for the year before, because a lot of surgeons wouldn't ever have gone in behind this kidney, because obviously if you move a kidney, it might stop functioning. So I was actually very lucky. The surgery was successful. The caller optimally debulked, which is not a great name, is it? But I think it basically means they got all of it out that can be seen with visually and on a CT scan. There was no evidence of disease once I'd been operated on. And then I started chemo.
Okay, so your treatment sounds like you underwent surgery before going on to start chemotherapy and like more drug therapy, basically.
I did. It can happen different ways. Some, there are ladies that I've met while having chemo who had some chemo first to shrink tumours and then had surgery and then more chemo. I think it very much depends on your individual diagnosis.
Yeah.
A lot of mine didn't seem to show up on a scan. It's a really funny one. I think because it can be so small, maybe it doesn't. Or so I didn't have any chemo prior to surgery. They were straight in. But we're all different, aren't we? So
yeah, absolutely. And like you said about actually getting the diagnosis and how it took having 2 years of the symptoms before you were actually diagnosed and then treated, you know, it's I think attributable to the fact that your symptoms were quite vague, like things like having the pain that you were experiencing or the back pain. It's like when you're at the age of 49, you might just assume that these might just be some normal symptoms or normal changes that my body is going through. And the fact that you have those symptoms for such a long time, you accepted that they're a normal part of your body when that wasn't the case. And I think one of the key points that I'd really like to emphasize to the listeners right now is really the importance of knowing your body and what's normal for you. And even if you have a symptom that isn't very, triggering or something that would prompt you to go see your GP like pain, you should still always seek medical advice if there's anything that's not normal for you or anything that's a bit unusual, especially if it's persisting for, you know, several weeks or even months for sure. So I guess that was really important. And you know, the fact that you said that because your journey of getting diagnosed was so extended, it was like over years, really, and then you eventually had your test, you were able to come to terms with the diagnosis when you were officially diagnosed. And it was such a big shock, even to an optimist like you. And I feel like, you know, comparing that to my journey when I was diagnosed, it was quite abrupt. Like I had no clue what was going on with me until I had my biopsy. And at 13 years, I didn't know what a biopsy is. So, you know, when my surgeon just told me, you know, you have a tumor and you're like, that was like the first time I knew what was wrong with me. And of course, very shocking to me because the first thing I thought was cancer anyway. So it's quite interesting to see how your journey was quite different to me in terms of getting the diagnosis in the first place. So, you know, thank you so much for sharing that. And in terms of, you know, when you eventually went on to receive your treatment, how would you say you dealt with everything?
I think because by nature, as I've said, I am an optimist, I do tend to just think, you know, you just have to get on with it. I mean, I think generally a lot of cancer patients or actually anyone facing any kind of life-changing diagnosis, the vast majority of humans just think, right, I've got to get on with it. How will I cope with this? I think my biggest concerns were my son. He was only 10. So how will I manage that? My husband still works offshore. He works in Oman. So how would we manage when he's away?
Yeah.
But, you know, you get through those things because usually people will help and support. There are always ways to get more help and like official help and support if you need it. But things just seem to work out. And I think in terms of the treatment, I didn't particularly have an easy time after the surgery because I had something called chylocystitis, which is a leaking lymph node. Behind the kidney where I'd had the problem, the lymph node hadn't sealed properly. So that's a really unusual condition. Which my surgeon was so excited about, which just is, you know. So I kept filling up with fluid, but it was this lymph fluid. So that was really tricky. And I had to do an extremely low, under 10 gram of fat a day diet to get it to hit, which it did because it stops you producing lymph fluid, which then allows the lymph system to heal. So I had to get to grips with all of those things like medium chain triglycerides. And so it was a funny old time. It was a bit like one thing happened, then another thing happened. But the support from the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle, dietitians there. I got some support from a hospital in London that specialised in chylocystitis. They were really open to help. So actually, what I found was the biggest thing was when I asked for help from anybody within the healthcare system, there was at no point did anybody say, oh, I'm sorry, that's not my job, or you're not my patient, or, you know, you live in the Northeast and I'm a hospital in London. People were just so willing to help, which was pretty incredible. And I think that then gives you kind of a real hope, positivity, because no matter how difficult things are, there are always really positive things that come along to show you that really things are going to be, you know, hopefully as okay as they can be, really.
Exactly. And I feel like it just makes you feel like you're not alone in your journey as well, because as long as you are, you know, speaking up and seeking that help, which there is a lot of available, whether it's family, friends or professionals, you know, you are going to get it. You're going to get that support that you need. It's just, you know, being courageous and being vulnerable in that moment to accept that you need help, and then everybody will do anything and everything they can to support you as much as possible. What about emotionally and, you know, the stress and anxiety that comes with, you know, entering treatment? And like you said, it's a bit of a roller coaster, really, you know, that sudden change in your life. How did you sort of cope with that? Was there anything that really got you through treatment?
I find the emotional thing a really funny one, in that when I was younger, so in my 20s and 30s, I did suffer from depression, periods of depression. Actually, when I was diagnosed, I kept waiting for this kind of wave of, you know, maybe depression to come back. I mean, I hadn't had it for a good, I think, probably 15 years, but still I kept thinking maybe this will trigger something. But it's never happened. I think that I've thought about this a lot, in that you are so grateful, and you may have found this, you are so grateful to just look at the sky, to just look at the grass, to just look at your family.
Absolutely.
But actually, I've never been so happy. It sounds absolutely crazy, but I think it's quite common for a lot of people when they face, you know, maybe death, to actually think, do you know what? My life's pretty amazing. So I've not ever struggled with my mental health since diagnosis. I think it's actually been the opposite. But I am very aware that that differs from person to person, and I'm not one to promote the idea that you have to be positive to have a good outcome. You know, I don't think it, you just have to go with whatever you dealt, don't you? It's just, I feel very lucky.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, I've been okay, but I know that's not the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, and when you have such a life-changing diagnosis, and you know, you have to accept a lot of things at once, you come to realize how many blessings you have in your life, and things like just, you know, a clear sky or a sunny day. There's such a privilege that you come to realize after facing something so scary. And you know, this just reminds me of one of your videos on Instagram, and one of the quotes or something that you mentioned is that we all must, you know, accept the darkness to truly enjoy the light. And I think that's kind of what a cancer diagnosis is. It's that darkness that suddenly comes into your life, but you will not truly be able to be that positive person that you truly are, or enjoy the light which is waiting at the end of the tunnel, until you actually just accept what's happened to you. And I think for yourself, that is something that you did, which helped you to be able to, you know, move on with your life and appreciate the tiny things around you, really.
Yeah, I do acknowledge though that there's an element of your place in the world. My, you know, I was 50 nearly when I was diagnosed. I wasn't just starting out. I didn't just have a mortgage. I didn't have lots of young children. We both had a job that was, so we could kind of cope with one. That puts you in a very different position than somebody who, because cancer did take away a lot from me. It took me away my ability to earn a living in the way that I had done before. And had I been younger and in a different position, the upheaval that would have come with a cancer diagnosis would have been much, it would have been enormous if I thought about maybe it happening 20 years before. So I am very aware that maybe my happiness comes from the fact that actually it's had an impact, but we haven't had to deal with the impact that some people will face because they're at a different time in their life. You know, there wasn't a massive financial burden associated with cancer that there would have been for me had I been in my 20s.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, you know, at different stages of your life, you've accomplished, you know, different goals, or like you said, financial stability can vary as well. And that truly, I think, sort of is a factor that contributes to how well you're potentially coping with a diagnosis of how your mental health is. You know, like for me, it was the complete opposite. I was just 13, 14. So I was literally at school. And the only concern I had was I want to go back to school, meet my friends, and go back to learning, because I was a geek, so I wanted to just be back at school. So, you know, my worries and concerns were very different to someone at your stage, you know, in your life. And that would be different to someone in their 20s, for example, where they're just starting their career or starting a family. So absolutely, I think these factors really dictate how you deal with a diagnosis and how you, you know, accept it, and what kind of impact it has on your mental health as well. And I guess I'm really happy to hear that for you it wasn't as bad, and you know, your depression didn't come back or you didn't experience a relapse, because it's already such an exhausting diagnosis, you know, physically and mentally it's quite draining, and you don't really want the added pressure of having to struggle with a mental health condition which you've already been through before. And I think, you know, having to experience it again, that negative sort of emotions that come with it can make it even more difficult to deal with a life-changing diagnosis. So it's really nice to hear how you were still able to, you know, continue with your life as normal and be that positive person you are.
Thank you.
Perfect. So in terms of, you know, your diagnosis, if I just go back to that again, you said that it took you 2 years, you know, was there a delay from your side specifically in actually going to seek that professional help and medical advice?
No, I would say that over the 2 years, I saw everybody I could, including, right, as I said, the surgeon who was the gynae oncology, head of gynae oncology at Gateshead.
Right.
So I saw everybody, and I went to see the doctor about, you know, could it be menopause? Could it be this? Could it be that? So I kept going. But I think because I was a woman of a certain age, you tend to be put into kind of, I mean, I'm talking from my own experience and from people that I've spoken to with an ovarian cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
There are all the things like IBS, pulled muscles, urine infection, that tend to be, or, well, you know, as you get to the menopause, it's not as easy as it was. Maybe you're having pain when you have sex because your lack of hormones, or so there were so many reasons that I was fobbed off. And now, looking back, I think my optimism is played a part in saying, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Even though deep down, I absolutely knew that I wasn't fine. If you are an optimistic person, you tend to go with the flow. So, yeah, I do think that played a part in the delay, because I just kept thinking, oh, I'll be fine. And also, towards the end, I had a very stressful year. My son's school closed. My mum, who was 90, in her 90s, so, you know, she died. My role was made redundant at work. So I had a lot of other things in the year running up to diagnosis that took my mind off the ball. And I remember even at my mum's funeral thinking, I've got to get this back pain checked out.
Yeah.
But then that was in the March, 1st of March. It still took maybe another couple of weeks again until I just went to the doctors and said, look, this is something definitely, you know, not right, because the pain was then, it was persistent. It was every day. I mean, if I don't think I would have done anything different had I heard of ovarian cancer, I would have done, but I'd never heard of it. Wasn't on my radar. I had all of my cervical screening checks, and as a lot of women do, thought that covered you for every gynae issue, you know. And it doesn't. So
exactly, and you know, just like you mentioned, with cervical screening, it doesn't screen for ovarian cancer, it screens for cervical cancer. And I think it's that lack of awareness of in terms of like women's health, the different cancers that can affect women, the different parts of your body that can be affected. And I think if we, you know, were to increase that awareness amongst women, you know, of all ages, not just, you know, of a particular age, every single age, it would just mean that we're more aware of our bodies, and we know exactly when to seek that professional help or medical advice and be very clear with our doctors. You know, I feel like this may be the case. And I think as patients as well, if you are empowered, if you are, you know, acting as that equal partner in care, you know, making that suggestion to your doctor, I'm sure they'll be very understanding of your perspective, because you're at the center of the care that they're providing. And if you are feeling a certain way, and, you know, at the end of the day, the patient knows their body best, not the doctor, then I'm sure the doctor will be more willing and more motivated to help you access the support you need or the healthcare that you need, whether it's at the diagnostic stage or treatment stage, really. Yeah. And, you know, just listening to how you went on to see your GP or see the surgeon, for example, it just shows how you wanted that diagnosis. You wanted to know what's wrong with me because you noticed there's a problem that was persistent. And I think, you know, as part of our work as cancer champions and our Cancer Smart initiative, one of the key things, you know, we really want to achieve is increasing that awareness in people of any sort of persistent change in the body that's not sort of resolving, anything that's unusual for them. And in, with ovarian cancer, unfortunately, the thing is that it's symptoms that are quite common. And they can be, they could be related to something like you said, IBS, for example, or a urine infection. So you wouldn't take them seriously. But sometimes these common symptoms can be the cause of something more serious, something more sinister. And it's really important to, you know, be proactive, go to see your GP, and even push them if you need to, because your health is a priority. And, you know, I think just another point was the fact that there are still women of certain communities, like the BAME community, for example, who may be like more reluctant to go for a smear test or to just go to the GP, because I think one of the key things they may feel is that they have a family, you know, they have so many responsibilities, and they're so sort of tied up with a lot of other things in their life, those commitments, that they neglect their health. I think, you know, it'd be nice coming from you, what you'd say to the women out there who are neglecting their health because they're so caught up with their responsibilities, you know, and what would you advise them to do in terms of taking care of themselves?
Well, firstly, I totally agree with what you've just said there. I think as women, we all do this. We all put everybody else's needs ahead of our own, because that's what we've seen our mums do and grandmothers do. And it's very much passed down through generation. And talking to women from other communities on Instagram, I realise that that's actually amplified even more in different communities in the UK. I think the one thing that I would say to any woman is, we all deserve good health. If we, if you know, it's a bit like that scenario of put your mask on in an aeroplane, your oxygen mask on before you put your child's on. Because if you don't put your own on, you might not get your child's on. If I wasn't here, I don't know what would have happened to, I mean, obviously my husband would have looked after my son, but that thought, that fear was absolutely horrendous, based on the fact that if I'd gone, you know, if I'd just not accepted what I was being told a little bit earlier, had I kept a symptom diary and gone to the GP with all of the symptoms together, because actually what I did was I went with one, then I went with another, then I went with another. I didn't go with this collection of symptoms. And saying to my GP, it hurts when I have sex, was actually, even, you know, I grew up in the 70s, I was born in the 60s, grew up in the 70s, think I'm really liberated. I find that really embarrassing. How can I find that really embarrassing when I've got a son that obviously I had to have sex to have a child? Yet I can't say to my GP, it really hurts when I have sex. And that is one, that was the first symptom I had before all of the others.
Right.
And actually, I think that's a really difficult thing for women to they need to just get their head around. It's just a symptom. It's not, you know,
I guess that association of embarrassment when you're talking about things, about certain parts of your body, I guess that's something that makes people more hesitant, I think, to speak to their GPs, because the GPs have seen everything and anything, really, all parts of your bodies, like from bodily fluid to poo, everything. Yeah. So, you know, it's normal for them. But I think as patients and women in particular, you just feel a sense of stigma for some odd reason. There's a lot of taboo around these topics, talking about them, even if, you know, some people are quite liberated, they might still feel very uncomfortable. And I think it's breaking those barriers and, you know, breaking down that discomfort and making them realize it's absolutely fine, it's normal. You're going to a professional, they're going to treat you professionally, they're not going to judge you or anything like that. And I think once you accept that, like, you know, acceptance is important, I think, in every aspect of life. If you accept that, it just makes it so much more easier to just be very truthful with your doctor and tell them everything. Even if some things you're doing, you know, you might not be comfortable sharing with a friend, it's okay to tell your doctor because they've probably heard it before anyways.
It's something I've become a lot more open about. I know that when I was first diagnosed, it was a symptom that wasn't very often seen on ovarian cancer charity's list of symptoms. But
yeah,
I've noticed over the past couple of years that it's there now, and I'm so pleased because it was my first symptom. You know, by the time I had a lot of the other symptoms, like the back pain, the tummy pain, actually it probably progressed quite, you know, quite extensively then. The painful sex was definitely the first thing. And if I'd paid more attention to that, you know, why would that suddenly happen? It had never happened before. I'd been married for, 12 years or something. Why would something just suddenly start to do that? That's quite an important symptom. And yet, because of what it was, I just didn't do what I should have done, which is said, I want this investigator and I want to know why it suddenly changed.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just before, you know, as part of my homework for this podcast episode, I did check up the symptoms of ovarian cancer because I have no clue what the symptoms are. And one of the symptoms is the, you know, pain during sex that you mentioned. So it is listed now. And I think it's really important to list any sort of symptom, both that are, you know, very much the main symptoms, the characteristic symptoms of a cancer, but any other atypical symptoms so that we're fully aware. Another point is in terms of your whole journey. I mean, you said that you don't really regret anything looking back in regards to what you did and what was in your control, because you did seek the help you needed and you didn't delay things. And I think that was because of the kind of person you are. And I think you're very much one of the patients we'd say are responsible for their own health and very health aware, you know, self-aware. But there are going to be patients who wouldn't, for example, go to see the GP that we've already discussed. And I think, you know, one of the key messages that we really want to emphasize is knowing your body and what's normal for you. And any sudden change or sudden onset of a symptom should always be, you know, that bit of a red flag, not necessarily a red flag, but that alert sort of signal for you to sort of notice that something's up. I need to, you know, monitor this. You said that keeping a symptom diary, for example, would have been really helpful. So yeah, maybe keep a symptom diary, make a note of what's going on, what's not quite right for you, document it. If it improves, then that's great. But if it keeps, you know, persisting, then take that diary to your GP and discuss it with him or her. And I think that's like the best way to go forward with getting a diagnosis for anything. You know, we're talking about cancer right now, but it could be any condition. So, you know, recently I came across an article. It was regarding a trial for ovarian cancer screening. Have you heard of this previously?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Right. And I think one of the key findings was that from the study, they found there wasn't a significant difference in mortality rates between those who were screened, for example, and diagnosed earlier with ovarian cancer, so at like stage 1 and 2, versus someone who was diagnosed at a later stage because they were not receiving screening. So, you know, what are your thoughts and feelings about this research and the findings?
I mean, obviously, it was initially when I heard it, I was really disappointed because for me, I suppose we know the effectiveness of screening for breast cancer, cervical screening. So for a lot of women who have ovarian cancer, thinking about the next generation of women, we have always maybe talked about screening being the way forward. What I think this showed was the tools that they were using for screening, like ultrasound and CA125, aren't adequate as screening tools. So I don't think it discounts screening full stop. I think what it does is tells us that they're not necessarily the right tools to use. You know, as I said to you, I had a vaginal ultrasound a year before my diagnosis. A really experienced surgeon who just said you've got functional cysts. So somehow in the future, they will find, I think, a tool that will screen successfully for ovarian cancer and help women to access the treatment they need before it's kind of dispersed to wherever it wants to go within your abdominal cavity. I absolutely 100% believe that. I just think we're not there yet. And I think that it's just a matter of time. It may be, you know, a genetic, they may find a gene that has some kind of like relevance to this. I know we've got the BRCA genes, but or the BRCA abnormalities, but there must be more out there that we've not yet discovered. So I'm really, really hopeful that in the future, whether that's 5 years, 10 years, we will find something. I just think it's not there yet. And actually, sometimes what you find out that doesn't work is as helpful as what does, because it stops you wasting time on stuff that's just not going to have the impact.
Absolutely. And I truly, you know, echo what you've just said right now, because even though the findings from this particular trial and the study weren't promising, it sort of made us aware that, okay, this thing isn't working so well, the ultrasound may not be as sensitive, but we can now redirect and look at further, you know, research or further like investigating other tests that may be more helpful. And, you know, gene sequencing, for example, and mutations, definitely, you know, that's been really helpful for women with breast cancer, for example. And maybe that might be something that helps us with the diagnosis of ovarian cancer. So I absolutely, you know, agree with everything that you've said. And I think based on like when this study was conducted, it's been, I think, a very long time since, so many years now, since these women were screened, and there's been so much more advancement in the treatments available for ovarian cancer. I believe now we've got more like targeted therapies, so they're more sort of specific for those cancer cells and not your, you know, healthy cells, which obviously means a better quality of life, because you won't experience those very unpleasant side effects that come with chemotherapy, because it's just attacking the bad cells, the cancer cells. So I think there has been progress in other fields or other aspects as well. So even though the screening wasn't so successful, treatments, you know, we're looking at more new drugs coming into the market to treat women with ovarian cancer. So that's definitely, you know, progress. And like I said, you know, this failure or this something that wasn't so effective has shown us that there's other avenues we need to explore, and that's okay. And that's why, you know, research in the area of cancer is so important. And is there anything else that, you know, you'd like to share with the listeners today about your journey, whether it's regarding the diagnosis, your symptoms or treatment, or how your life has been so far as a cancer patient?
I do think it's really important to talk about the fact that actually you can still have a really positive, you can have a wonderful life with cancer, mm-hmm. living with cancer. It may not be the same life, but it's wonderful. But one thing I would like to say is ovarian cancer is often talked about as rare.
Yeah.
And they'll talk about it's rare in young women. It's rare anyway. But what I would absolutely say is that kind of tagging it or calling it rare has no benefit to anybody, because I know women that are 23 when they were diagnosed. Mm-hmm. To them, it doesn't matter that it's rare. It still happened to them. By saying it's rare, it can take it off the table for some people, because they're kind of like, well, it never happened to me. And actually, it takes nothing to learn the symptoms of ovarian cancer. And then it's just there in the back of your head. You don't have to think about it, but it might just click if you see, you know, if you start feeling some of the symptoms, at least, you know, you're going to get them checked. So although it's more common in women of postmenopausal women or women of menopausal age, it can still happen in younger women. And it's definitely something that should be on. Well, anybody with ovaries really needs to be concerned about the ovary health and making sure that they're aware of whether their ovaries are healthy or not. I used to be very much in the moment and I wouldn't think very far ahead, and I've got better at looking ahead as the years. I mean, I didn't think I'd be here now. You know, that's the stats were extremely poor. Yeah. And I suppose that's something else you learn. You're not a statistic, are you? So, you know, you're not a statistic. I'm not a statistic.
Exactly. And like, you know, this is something I wanted to touch upon regarding rare diseases, whether it's, you know, ovarian cancer, bone cancer, or any other cancer that's rare. You know, it doesn't mean that it can't happen to you. And it doesn't mean it's not important because less people are affected by it, because even that small percentage of people, their lives are equally important. And, you know, they hold the same value as 80% of or 70% of people are being affected by a different cancer. I mean, that's not an accurate statistic, but as an example, you know, their lives are equally valuable. They are still just as human. They still have, you know, their own respective lives, their interests, the things that they enjoy. And, you know, it's really important for, I think, as healthcare professionals, you know, for them to be more aware of rare diseases, rare cancers, so that those patients are, you know, treated just like somebody with a more common cancer are treated in terms of getting their diagnosis early, because for any cancer, an early diagnosis would always be, you know, what we really want as a healthcare professional, even, you know, so that you get them treated with the less harsh treatments and you're maximizing their quality of life. So absolutely, you know, I really want to reinforce the point that you've said about we're more than a statistic. We have a life. And I think why you're, you know, doing the 2 days and lecturing was so valuable to you and so sweet for you was because it was the courage that you showed in holding on to who you truly are and what makes Lisa Lisa. You know, it was doing those things that made you happy, whether it was something involving physical activities and sports, for example, or your job, and, you know, are you being very passionate and dedicated to that, or just speaking to those students and being able to relate to them. It was all a part of you and the positive person that you are. Even with such a scary diagnosis like ovarian cancer, you pushed through, you accepted it, you accepted that darkness around you, but you didn't let it dim your light. You still, you know, shone probably brighter than you ever would have if you weren't diagnosed. You know, it probably allowed you to grow in ways you didn't think you could grow in. I mean, you definitely become a scarf stylist for sure. I'm really loving the trends here and, you know, doing all those tutorials on Instagram. But, you know, I think cancer makes you a more empathetic and sensitive person. And I think anything, not just cancer, you know, a life-changing event, it truly teaches you things that you wouldn't learn from normal life, you know, through working a 9-to-5 job or, you know, through other relationships. It's just a very unique experience that allows you to grow as a person in a way you didn't think was possible, and to experience a level of positivity that you didn't know was within you. You know, like for me personally, I feel like during treatment, it was a bit of a fight or flight response. I was just fighting this cancer. That's all that was on my mind. However, you know, at any moment where my body recovered, I'd always find time to do something I enjoyed, which was being creative. So whether it was painting or making like a stuffed toy or anything, like jewelry making, it got me through those dark days. It was really minor. It was such a tiny activity, but it gave me that positivity, that hope that, you know, actually I'm still able to be on chemo and do this thing I really enjoy and live my life. This is what life is about. It isn't about how many years I'm going to live with cancer or after cancer. It's about now, what is in, you know, this moment right now. And I think one of the key things my doctors and all my healthcare professionals would really, you know, emphasize to me is take one day at a time. Don't think about 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 5 months from now, or tomorrow. Just think about now, this very moment, and live it to the fullest. And I think what you've just said is a true example of, you know, having a life with cancer. You can absolutely survive, live a life and be you, even if you have a cancer diagnosis. And I know that you had those preconceptions about how a cancer patient can't go to work, they can't do this and that, but that is absolutely not true. You know, every human being, whether you have cancer or not, has those good days and bad days where you're up to do X, Y, Z in the day, and then some days you just can't. You're just not in the right frame of mind. You're not feeling like you can pour out whatever it is that you can offer to the world. So it doesn't matter if you have cancer or not. As long as you're doing your best, that's what truly matters. And I think you absolutely are. I mean, I can't imagine having a son, having a husband, a family to look after, and then a job and going through cancer. It truly blows my mind. You know, I have zero responsibilities and I still struggle with my life. So, you know, it's truly so commendable to see how far you've come and how much you've achieved. And especially with your Instagram blog, Ovarian Cancer and Other Stories, I think it's literally positivity. It's a place where I know I can go and watch any of your videos and I have a big smile on my face. It really, you know, is something that I think is making a difference to many other people part of the cancer community. And I'm so grateful I was able to connect with you through Instagram as well.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. I do. Instagram's probably been one of the biggest positives from a support perspective. And I think it's because, you know, although we may all have cancer, but you still have to find your own little community of people that you would have got on with, even if cancer wasn't part of the kind of the reason that you got together. And I think Instagram allows you to do that because there's so many people. You can connect on many different levels. But I have found a really great support network of women on there. I say women because I think 90% of the people that watch my stuff are women. So I think the other 10% are probably relatives. Feel that they should follow. It's been a good way of trying to raise awareness and connect with other people who've gone through similar. You know, though, with I talk about work and talk about what I do, but things have changed for me a lot over the 5 years. And, you know, at the moment, for the past year, I've been working from home, lockdown and teaching online. And I know that looking at the new academic year, I don't know whether I'll, because I'm having weekly treatment now, which is very different from having it every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what I'll be able to do in 4 months' time, 5 months' time, but I'll cope with that when it happens. And exactly. I'm not, you know, there is nothing wrong with saying, actually, I can't do that anymore because I haven't physically got the strength. And then finding something else, maybe it's just reading a lot of books or sitting on the bed with your dog. As long as it supports your mental health and you're happy, I suppose that's the important thing. Work was an important thing for me because of who I am and what my life has been. But for some people, that may be gardening or, you know, it could be anything as long as it's something that makes you happy and feel like you, I think is what I'm trying to say. I definitely wouldn't say that everybody needs to go out and get it. It's not something that they want to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup. If you're not filling yourself in with things that make you happy, you know, make you realise that you love yourself, you know, you accept yourself for who you are, how are you going to, you know, give out that positivity or, you know, that productivity in your own life or to the people around you? You just won't be able to do that. And like, as women in particular, you know, we're so busy catering to the needs of people around us that we neglect ourselves so much. So always, you know, put yourself first. And I really liked the example you gave of the oxygen mask in an airplane and how it's like, you know, you need to put yours on first before you put your child's on. So, you know, in life as well, I think to our listeners, I really want to emphasize the importance of taking care of yourself, doing what makes you happy and setting boundaries on what you can and cannot do. And it's okay if something, you know, you were previously able to do, you cannot do now. You know, I used to love football. I used to love running. Can't run anymore. I'm not allowed to post surgery, but that's okay because I decided to, you know, gather that energy or passion I had for a sport and use that to do other things. So, for example, doing this podcast today. Yeah. So it's okay. There's so many things to experience in life. There's so much more that life has to offer to you and you have to offer to life. And it's just that acceptance and moving forwards as opposed to, you know, staying stagnated in the past. You don't want to do that. And, you know, just to wrap things up, is there any other message that you'd like to give to our listeners from, you know, lifestyle to positivity or hope, anything that you'd like to say?
No, just I suppose it would be just to reiterate the symptoms of ovarian cancer, you know, bloating, pain when you're having sex, changing bowel habits, needing to wee more often, struggling to eat or feeling full really quickly. You know, it's not a massive exhaustive list, but they're just a few things that really, if you keep them in the back of your mind and you experience any for more than 3 weeks, I would definitely go and get them checked out.
Absolutely. And just to add to that, you know, you also experience the back pain and pain during sex. So anything, the most embarrassing of symptoms, if they're not getting better, if they're persisting, they're very unusual for you, please, you know, do go to see your GP. If you know anyone who's experiencing these symptoms, then, you know, likewise, do the same. Encourage them to see their GP and seek that medical advice, because an early diagnosis can, you know, truly transform your outcomes and your quality of life. So that's it. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lisa. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I feel so inspired by your story. You know, I just feel so privileged to have spoken to you today. And you truly are a ray of sunshine and so much hope for so many people as part of the cancer community.
Oh, that's really kind of you. Thanks ever so much, Arzu. I really appreciate it. Thanks for giving me the time today.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of the You Can Survive podcast with the wonderful and truly inspirational Lisa today. If you would like further information on the symptoms of ovarian cancer, please visit the NHS website on www.nhs.uk/conditions/ovarian-cancer. Also, if you would like to access any further support, webinars, or useful information regarding ovarian cancer, do visit the Overcome website. That's www.overcome.org.uk. Remember that the symptoms that Lisa just mentioned at the end can affect women of any age group, whether you're postmenopausal or not. So please do be aware of your bodies. And with that, we reach the end of the first season of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. We really hope you enjoyed listening to the inspirational stories of our amazing guests and have learned something from their journeys. Please stay tuned for season 2 of You Can Survive, which will be returning next year. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast and supporting it this far. This podcast is brought to you by the West Yorkshire and Harrogate Cancer Alliance and patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. To find out more, visit us on our website. That's www.yorkshirecancercommunity.co.uk/cancersmile. Thank you.